Hello, iGaming Intelligentsia. Before we start today's podcast, here is a message from our sponsors. The iGaming Next podcast is made possible with the support from our sponsors at Pragmatic Solutions, leaders in intelligent platform technology. I've been working with Ashley, Lewis, and the guys over at Pragmatic Solutions over the last year. And as the early supporter of this podcast, I cannot recommend them enough. The Pragmatic Solutions Player Account Management Platform is an incredibly powerful technology stack for today's gaming business. Their modern modular platform provides all the core services to power your business, and their SaaS licensing model allows you to reduce cost and accelerate your strategic goals. Enterprise technology with decades of operational know-how at scale built in. Upgrade your business to the Pragmatic Solutions PAM platform. Visit www.pragmatic.solutions to arrange a platform demo.
Future trends, deep insights, industry leaders. This is the iGaming Next podcast with your host, Pierre Lindt.
What's the difference between an Estonian batsman and a Formula One car?
Oh, Estonian batsmen don't take quick singles. Probably the first thing that springs to mind.
Nothing. If you blink, you'll miss them both. I was thinking, why don't we start with the absolute lowest point as it can possibly go today, and then we can only go up from here. Because I know you're an avid cricket fan.
I don't know, Pierre. I think we can go to many, many low depths here as well, if need be. But no, you're right. I do love my cricket and can proudly say I've been the captain of the National Estonian cricket team for many, many years. And we're part of the ICC. We're ranked 72 in the world. And one of my great hobbies in life is just to get away from work and have a Saturday afternoon playing cricket with the boys and competing on international level as well. It's if you're going to do something, do it properly and do it well and make the most of it, because you only live once. So yeah, it's a great way to get away from work and away from the telephone and play chess with a ball is what it really is.
Yeah, right. You only live once. That's as in the name of your investment fund, by the way. And a jack of many trades.
Yes.
Yeah, a jack of many trades, Tim. And I want to start on that front today a little bit. I mean, Tim, I've known you now for the last year or so, since you kind of came on board with us at iGaming Next. And something that I've noticed is you're probably the most switched on, always available, connected person within the iGaming industry that I have met in my 15 years in this industry. And it's something, sometimes your name comes up in various situations and whatnot. And we always say the same thing. It's like when does Tim Heath sleep? He's always available. So I would like to start just asking, what does a day in Tim Heath's life look like?
God, yeah, no 2 days are the same. It's in the last 2 weeks, I think I was telling someone my travel was from Tallinn to Kiev. We're opening a Bombay studio down there. Then I flew to Slovenia, then to Nice to look at a boat in Monaco, then on to Marbella, then down to Gib for meetings and back to Marbella for meetings, then flew to Lisbon for a dinner. Then I flew back to Tallinn, had one day in Tallinn full of meetings. Then I flew to St. Petersburg for a VIP event with some of the Bit Casino VIPs and look after them, and going to the football on the Friday night. We went to the Spain-Switzerland game, and then flew back to Tallinn because I had cricket on the Saturday afternoon. So it's what one thing I do enjoy is flying, because I'm not connected to the internet and I can actually sort of sitting above the clouds and you can think about where things are going to move to and have some time and peace yourself. But on land, on terra firma, everybody is very, very connected. And it is, I nearly feel it's an obligation if someone writes to me, I can answer them quickly with a good answer. And it does get very, very hard sometimes when you have so many varied things going on to try and keep abreast of everything. And then, you've got family and relationships, and you've got my parents are in Australia who I haven't seen a year and a half. So mum's always good for a call for an hour on a Sunday night. And, so just trying to fit everything in does get difficult, but I think you need to make quick decisions, be well informed, be well read, and then have an opinion. And that opinion doesn't always have to be right. But the worst thing you can do is not have an opinion and say, oh, let's have a meeting about that. But you don't need to have a meeting about that later. You need to, there's a situation, work out what the best possible answer, given the information, have luck playing poker, make a decision, make your move, and then get on to the next one. And it might not be perfect and it might fail. And if it fails, will you learn from it and make a better decision next time? But I think that's one thing people do struggle with, is wanting to be too perfect with their decision-making process, where life's too short to be perfect. So get on, make a decision and deal with the consequences, and hopefully make more better decisions than worse decisions. It's as simple as that.
Right, right. But seriously though, are you a vampire, Tim? Because it's between us. I mean,
I have in the past done a lot of work in the evenings, and I used to probably go to bed at 4 a.m. and work late. But I am getting a little bit better in that regard and trying to switch off. But I do enjoy the nighttime because it is a bit of peace and quiet to work. The issue we have these days, you know, we have teams in Brazil, we have teams in Australia and teams in Taiwan, that you might switch off from the Estonian time zone, then the next time zone comes on, then the next time zone comes on. Right. So you can always be always on and always. And the thing is, there's no end point to what you can do. It's exactly. There's always someone else you can be helping. But I think it's now just sort of trusting the team around you and hopefully mentoring them or helping them to a stage where they're making their good decisions, and you know, let them make 4 out of 5 decisions, and they come and talk about one that they're not 100% sure on. I think trusting your team to make good decisions actually helps you scale businesses further.
Yeah. I just finished actually a really good book that's called Principles by Ray Dalio, who operated the Bridgewater, the biggest investment fund in the world. And he basically lays out his whole procedures for how his organization should work in principles. And one of his principles for himself is that he spends 1 hour per direct report that he has in his company. Mm-hmm. And then he expects them to work 50 hours. So he spent 1 hour per 50 hour with a 1-to-50 ratio. I thought that was quite an interesting little observation there. I really recommend that book, by the way, Principles. Super cool.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it's like anything, the more time you invest in the early days to shape someone on how you want them to work, it will repay you in X multiple factors down the track. So you can get to a stage where 1 hour a month is enough to catch up on, making sure the people who are coming to have that one-on-one with you, they're prepared with an agenda, knowing what they want to go through, and go bang, 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 and really training people to be time efficient. You can waste so much time in meetings. we have this management development program, and I always say, you've got 2 hours a week over 4 months to work on your project. And I guarantee the first meeting will go for an hour and a half because people are too scared to make a decision. By the end of the 4 months, they're doing 15, 20-minute meetings where you distill the essence and you know what you need to achieve, and you're not kind of embarrassed to step up and make that decision or worried about the people around you. When everyone is rowing in the same direction and you know what needs to be achieved, you can cut through the crap and just get on with what needs to be done. Now, look, you still need a Friday night out for a few beers and some downtime and, you know, chew the fat with people, and that's all good. But when you're at work, it's about the efficiency of decision-making process, which allows you to achieve more and greater output as well. So I can agree with the 1 hour for 50. Probably, it's probably a fairly good principle in that sense.
Yeah, that's a good ratio. So Tim, you built Coin Gaming Group from scratch to what are you now, like 500 plus employees or something like that?
600 employees now.
Yeah, 600. Yeah. Jesus. And so and
9 offices around the world.
Yeah, and so obviously you have stepped aside from taking the active CEO role now, of course. But when you built this organization, did you as the top dog of the organization, have you kind of what changes what changes in the way you manage the organization have you seen through this growth from 0 to let's say 500?
Obviously, with more projects going on, the dissemination of information has been the hardest one. So as a team of 30, 40 people, there's an idea comes out, from 4 o'clock in the morning the night before, and you can tell over a morning coffee all the key stakeholders, and you know it's going to filter through and you can action that straight away. When you have 20 different departments within an organization, yes, I might talk to someone about an idea and work through the idea and whiteboard at 1 o'clock, but then there's all of a sudden 6, 7, 8 different people who need to be aware of what's going on, and that's where that sort of process comes into place. As soon as you implement that process, it takes time to sort of communicate that idea and understand how it needs to be. So things tend to slow down, development tends to slow down, new business concepts tend to slow down because there's just so many more actors involved in the execution of an idea. And it pains me, excuse me, it pains me because I've always been very, very fast. And, you know, I want to call my CTO up, Rayo, and just say, right, we'll talk for an hour about and spitballing how its company's going to work. And he'd go out the next day and build it. But now he's got this thing called a backlog, and they've got these things called priorities. And apparently people don't like priorities being changed. I don't know why, because, you know, I'm of the idea that hasn't worked. Here's a better one. Let's do that. And then we do the employee feedback surveys, obviously, and try and provide a good environment. But one of the things was one of the bad things, changing priorities. And I'm like, that's a good thing. But for some people, they're not built the same way. And learning to respect and understand that from my prerogative was one of the hardest challenges, but probably one of the most important things to understand. I set a vision from a 40,000 foot view. People execute from a 4,000 foot view, and then people operate from a 40-foot view. And I can't get myself involved in those 40-foot decisions, and not so often the 4,000 foot decisions anymore. I need to trust the team I've put in place who can execute on that. And look, Mario and Anita have stepped into the role and it's been exceptional. We've doubled our numbers, our turnover in GGR in the last 12 months, and all credit honestly must go to them for executing and really aligning those process. And these people enjoy process, and, you know, being efficient with that is a good thing, but it's certainly not for me anymore to be in the trenches trying to do stuff. That said, I still like popping in to customer support at 11 o'clock on a Thursday night and sitting down for an hour on live chat, because I still want to hear what the customers have to say about it, because that helps me frame my mindset of where we're going to be in 12 months' time. The most important value I can add to the company from sitting on the board of Coin Gaming these days is sort of, it's not just a hierarchical, here's the vision. You, to understand the vision, you need to understand what the customers want. So I was in St. Petersburg with 6 of our VIPs, and I'm pulling the phone out, check this game out, what are we doing here, who are our competitors, what do we need to do better, and getting the information directly from the source, from these VIPs, and then filtering that back as a part of that sort of strategic vision for the next 12 months is what I'm good at, I think. So I hope. I don't know. We're doing all right, so it must be. That's the biggest challenge for me. And if I didn't have such a good team around me, it would be impossible. So I feel blessed and privileged every day that senior team in Coin Gaming, you know, led by Mario and Anita, it's just growing every single day, and couldn't be prouder. So really, really happy.
Yeah, no, it's really cool, and I saw Anita. She came on the Agami Next online event that we hosted here the other week to talk as well. I just thought she was fantastic. Yeah, actually, in describing kind of the future of the online gaming industry together with blockchain and crypto technology, and it seems that you have really gotten together your management team there. So nice to be able to step away, you know, after many years. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. But it's not stepping away. It's more just taking a different approach to step back from that 40,000 foot view, as I call it, and just say, right, where do we need to be in 12 months' time? We set those goals, those broad goals, and then the team will go and execute in them. And not everything works, and some things go better than others. And then we do need to have a little bit of shifting priorities sometimes because there's no, you know, in poker, don't throw good money after bad. So if it's not working, you've got to pull the plug very quickly and work out another way how to do it.
Right. You mentioned something before here, Tim, as well. You like to travel. You like to be on airplanes for the reason that you're disconnected, right? And I happen to be exactly the same, actually. I love flying for that purpose too. I take my
iPad, I take my little pen, and I just scribble down what's on my brain type of thing. And it's one of my favorite things to do, and one of the most valuable things for the company, for me, my time spent is having that time to sit down and do that as well. But I have a question on that. I've been trying to think, like, how can I find that flow when I'm not on an airplane? And it's really difficult, actually, and I don't have an explanation for it.
Yeah, it is. And I think when I'm back in Tallinn and I'm thinking, okay, well, tonight I'll do something, but this sort of when you're home, so many people want your time. I got to the office this morning and there was 8 people waiting outside my office door, wanting a piece of me. And as much as I had this idea, I wanted to do a couple of calls to Asia this morning, but it's like to sort of whiteboard something with a few people there, I just didn't have that chance. To that end, I think you need to really dislocate yourself that away from your normal day where the phone is pinging and things are going on. I like going places and, you know, you go out for a dinner and, you know, I'll take a notepad and I'll have a nice steak and then I'll sit down for an hour with a cup of tea and write that outside of my normal environment. And I think it's only then can you really detach yourself from that everyday buzz of what goes on in life and try and take that thinking time. But that's where travel, that's why I travel so much, because I do appreciate that time to really think through what's going on. But then at the same time, you need to be well read. You need to have time to read and to understand and to read the industry news, and you need to talk to people. One of the key things I love about traveling is I like to talk to people face to face. I like to have a few drinks and open up that mind and ask the good questions that you just can't do over a Zoom. And I think when you're selling something, when you're networking, doing it in person is just so much better. So I appreciate the opportunity to travel and be able to do that. And it takes its toll, obviously. It's but it's very, very important.
Right. So Tim, the topic of today is thinking big. I spoke about this a little bit before the podcast here, but the reason why I wanted to do the podcast today is just because there are some people that you meet at times and they just have a different way of thinking. You know, let's say that you come across a new massive building, for example. Some people, they see this building and they think, I would love to live there one day. And then there are other people who see this building and they think, I would like to own that building one day. And there are a few people who slide into that. And that's what kind of, through the year of knowing you, that is what has been a bit inspiring for me to see the way you think in this regard, because you always think big. And one of the areas that this is a great example in is, if we look at the iGaming industry, we all know that it's very difficult to do banking in the iGaming industry, right? So operators are constantly figuring out different ways to bank and how to move money around, essentially. And that is the local problem that they are dealing with. And then Tim Heath, he doesn't think, how can I find a new banking solution? Instead, you decided to own a bank so that you can basically remove this problem altogether. Yeah, and also offer this solution to other banks, to other iGaming companies who are dealing with this issue. Can you talk about that product a little bit?
Yeah, I can. And look, the genesis of it all was, it is difficult to do banking from the iGaming world. And for some reason, people think it's high risk. I think it's the most low risk business. You know, you're guaranteed a 4% margin on every single bet over the long term. So it's not very high risk in that sense. That said, it is a difficult environment for banking. Some banks I know will have 2 floors full of people doing compliance, doing nearly pointless compliance to the nth degree because there's been some mandate gone out. And, you know, HSBC gets away with Mexican drug cartels, but, you know, we get asked on the origins of a 500 euro invoice payment, can you please send the agreement, the contract, the pro forma, and, you know, your fingerprints, I don't know what, you know, something stupid. So the interesting thing, so the head of compliance for TransferWise plays cricket with me in Tallinn, and I was asking him, I said, mate, why won't TransferWise onboard us? You know me, you know my background, who we are, we're not bad actors. He goes, you're not worth our time.
Right.
And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, yes, you've got a complicated group structure. Yes, we understand, you know, you're doing it all compliantly and correctly and whatnot, but our compliance team don't understand that. They understand an e-commerce shop, like a Shopify shop, with money in, money out. You've got stuff here, there, everywhere. There's no return on investment for us to spend that amount of time to make sure you are compliant with 37 group companies. So I'm like, okay, if this is I can understand that. That's a legitimate reasoning. Looking at it and going, right, well, we need our own bank. Now, you could go and get an EMI license in Lithuania. You can buy one off the shelf. And I honestly think it's a bit of a quicksand sandpit in Lithuania. There's so many EMIs in there that might be a bit of a house built on shaky foundations. That said, some people have gone ahead from the income industry and set up there and charging ridiculous amounts of money, and good luck to them. Supply and demand, there's the spot of the business opportunity, and charging 0.5% at every deposit, and that's a wonderful business model. But we thought perhaps there's something bigger here we can do. We have a lot of activity in Asia, and so do many European operators these days, and needing to move money back without going through money changes and whatnot. So, well, if we invest into a banking group and we're getting a UK EMI license, we know we want to get a Luxembourg EMI license for the Euro, for the Eurozone. We do a lot in Dubai, so we can go and get a Dubai full private bank solution. Singapore is very proactive in the crypto space in Asia and a very stable environment after Hong Kong had a few problems. So that we can go and get an EMI license there. And we've also got a Philippine full banking license as well. Now, imagine you could then connect all those five banks together. Then you can put on the crypto solution using the Lightning Network that you can move money instantaneously outside the SWIFT network, which is, if we think about the real issue here, the SWIFT network and the corresponding banks, they're the ones who have the risk and compliance areas. So how do we solve that by not going through the SWIFT network to move money around the world? So using the Lightning Network, we can. There's atomic swaps and whatnot. I can go into more detail if you're interested. But pretty much you can move money from Singapore to London instantaneously at the best possible Forex rate using programmatic auctions for buy and sell Bitcoins to move the money. Now, you need all the money in Europe? Do you need all the money in the UK? Actually, you don't. Potentially, it's an idea to diversify your asset base and have money around the world strategically, and let your Asian money that you earn pay for your Asian businesses and content and SEO and whatever else, and then European stuff doing this and your crypto stuff doing something else. And it's like, if we can solve this for the Coin Gaming Group needs, excuse me, I know there are other people out there who would love a solution like this, because we're solving so many problems for us that we personally feel every day, that I'm sure other people have the same issue. So we're still full compliance within under the FCA license, but our compliance team come from a gaming background, so we understand how a Curaçao company works, how a Maltese company with a holding company in Gibraltar works, paying 6-7% of the tax and whatnot, how all those structures work. We understand because we've been doing it for 20 years. Let's put our compliance team in the banking infrastructure with that knowledge, become a boutique bank servicing this industry and fintech and crypto industry as well. And all of a sudden, we have a very, very attractive solution. We've got a very competent team building this, to the extent we're now looking at a bank in Mauritius and a bank in Brazil and potentially one in Mexico, because we can see that cross-border payments growing as we grow our own personal needs. So by taking that kind of 40,000-foot view, it's like we're not just solving an immediate small problem on where to store money, but actually what does the future look like and what will be needed to be done. To build onto this, we're building our own accounting software, because there's no accounting software in the gaming industry which accounts for GGR and NGR and bonuses and loyalties and chargebacks, and the zero is good, it doesn't account for crypto. Sage is good, or SAP is good, whatever the German one is, but that's no idea what GGR means. So it's like, let's build our own, and then let's put that accounting software into the banking software, into the internet banking portal. Anyone can then use the accounting software, and you know what? Instead of the $100 coming in and going 98 here, 95 there, and 92 there, if we get everybody banking on our intrabank network, the $100 comes in and it disperses on the click of a pay invoice from the accounting software through open banking. All of a sudden, you've created efficiency. And it makes sense because it's got checks and balances automatically built in. We know we work with a NetHand, MicroGaming, Pragmatic, PlayAngo, Yggdrasil, OneTouch, Columba, GreenJade. If we can provide them as a service, we can say you can have T plus one settlement as opposed to T plus 90 settlement, T plus 30 settlement. Cash is king. The faster we can move the money for everyone, the more happier everyone is. Now, you don't need to leave your money in that network. You can still do a separate transaction and take it out somewhere else, but at least that operational efficiency is there. And where the idea comes, it's fun to think about what is fucked up with the banking industry at the moment and how we can solve it. And honestly, how we can charge a fair price for this, because I know people will come. We've got 40 gaming companies waiting to be onboarded into our banking network because they know we'll do it fair. We'll know it's fun and, you know, it's fast, but it solves a problem. And it's fun, fast, and fair. And that's our whole model and everything we do. But we're solving people's problems. And this is good fun. And it's actually then becomes good business as well. So, yeah, it's where it all comes from is what do we need to improve ourselves? And then I'm sure there's others out there who will enjoy the efficiency we create, which ends up being good business. So, sounds pretty much mum says I'm out of control, apparently.
God damn it, Tim. I need to come on a flight with you at some point in the like the next brainstorming and basically take over the whole conference industry and the entire world and the solar system together. Amazing, Tim. So essentially what you're doing is you're building a boutique bank solution that is tailor-made for the iGaming industry specifically, but then you mentioned also fintech and crypto fintech space
and crypto as well.
As well, right? It seems that this is exactly what the industry needs. I mean, I know from behind the scenes of the last couple of years, this is something that has been discussed in the industry organization forums from an operator level. Some of the CEOs have discussed that. Potentially go together a couple of organizations and create a bank together, but then nothing comes through it. It kind of falls through priorities, day-to-day work, stuff like that. Here you come and you kind of, not only do you offer this banking solution now, but you seem to take it much, much further as well. It's very interesting.
Well, what we're finding as well, our banking network, it's also got the crypto license. It's an OTC desk, over-the-counter desk. So it's buying and selling crypto for a lot of the big industry players at the moment. What we want to do within the bank, internet banking, euros, pounds, dollars, BTC, Ethereum, Tron, USDT. So it's like a bank account that you want to now convert between USDT and euro. You click one button, it brings you a good rate. Yeah, sure, there's going to be 20 pips on the price because we've got to pay the electricity, but it's going to be so seamless that you can now receive your USDT in from Asia into that bank, convert it to pounds, move it out somewhere else, and it's automated. And this is what the industry is crying out for, especially in Asia. It's all gone crypto now. It's quite surreal how big that crypto market is. But compliance is never going to disappear. So don't think that having your own banking network, you can now cut corners. You can't. It's the regulations are there. There's the AML 6 directive. That's not going to appear. So we're going to do it properly and regulate it, but we're going to try and make it as seamless and as efficient as possible. Yeah. And even we've got a thing called Open Wallet, which is like a browser extension connecting in your virtual IBANs, but also you're doing KYC at a bank. We then have tokenized KYC. You can pass through to a casino. You don't need to KYC every single time. We've done it from a banking infrastructure. You pay 10 cents and you get that. If you need the documents, you go back and ask for them. But and again, it makes then casinos working more efficiently and better and removing those pain.
So it's kind of like MetaMask, for example, in the crypto space, the same as open banking solution, what you are doing. You see, I'm learning here since last podcast. That's we did together.
Interestingly, we're working with MetaMask to build the wallet, but we want to then build in the open banking interface into MetaMask and then have a swap there on a consumer level between euros and Ethereum within that, and then you open your payment channel to a casino as well. So again, how do we improve the solution for the customer? This works. Right. This is good.
Yeah, right. So it's kind of like what you're trying to offer here is, let's say, a trustless pay and play that works in Sweden, for example, Scandinavia. It's a similar solution that would then work kind of for the rest of the world. Let's say now, or in Europe, I guess open banking is...
Rest of the world.
Okay.
Because, through your bank, you know... Okay. Europe, you have the open banking directives coming from the EU.
PSD2, yes.
46 countries in the world have an open banking directive, not known as open banking. Like in Brazil, it's called PixPay. In Australia, it's called something else. In Singapore, it's called something else. How you then connect all those ones into it as well. We're thinking from a European mentality with open banking. Now, you know, you've got companies like Vault coming in and being that aggregator of different open banking solutions. We connect them into their final product and then give the customers a good solution there.
So Trustly should watch out, in other words.
Trustly should be looking and trying to understand where the market's moving in 12 months' time and start planning for that as well.
Right.
And go back to the old Kodak moment. You know, Kodak was great in the 80s, but they didn't invest into understanding. When you become too proud of what you've got and you're not, you dismiss other things, that's when you've lost the battle. You need to have what you're doing is really well. And funny here, CoinGaming, you're probably going, Tim, can't you stop and enjoy the moment of what we're doing? I'm like, no, because I guarantee you in 12 months' time there'll be something else happening. If we stop and rest, we've done the Kodak moment. So Trustly should be out there looking at these types of solutions and investing those profits into the next thing to make sure there's that continual perpetual momentum always moving forward.
Right.
Or that don't have to, and I'll do it.
Yeah, exactly. And so if I understand correctly, so essentially, you know, you went to TransferWise, the guy, he said, you know, you're too much hassle, it's too much manual labor for us to understand that you are a good customer. And so essentially what you're doing here, you're offering this this boutique service where your due diligence process is essentially tailor-made to approve gaming companies. So like due diligence team will essentially understand in a much more efficient way what is a nefarious client and who is not in our space, let's say. That is the competitive advantage, coupled with obviously your knowledge and expertise in the crypto space and moving money.
If you look at that, so Curaçao as a jurisdiction, there's the four master licenses and there's the sub licenses. Now, different banks in Europe don't understand this and get this. They don't understand how that structure works. We have people who have worked with Curaçao license before and understand exactly who the main four master license holders are and how to validate that's correct. Same in the Kanawaki or the Philippines as well. If you have people understand that framework, then it becomes much easier to understand, are they a good actor or a bad actor, and can we work with them in the future?
Because it must be a massive minefield. I mean, if you take the wrong step and you onboard one wrong client, that, you know, we're talking millions and millions of euro fines here, because I guess that is where the tricky part comes in here, which TransferWise then obviously want to avoid, let's say. It's just the massive minefield that is banking and due diligence and AML. Like, how is that? Will you sleep well at night? Like, when you operate this bank?
I won't be operating the bank. I'm investing into the bank and providing strategic guidance where we need to get to. We've got a team in London, a 20-person compliance team there doing it, who have had the skill working from PayPal, from Skrill, from I think it was checkout.com, some of the guys are from. So they've had that experience. They are the experts in their industry. We then bring in that game expertise as well, and we help them understand what a good structure looks like. That's how this is where the genesis of YOLO came from, is that we want to invest into these companies and provide that strategic advice to them on where the business opportunity is. But we want the guys who are running the company to continue running the company and growing that valuation through their best practice and their expertise that they have in their niche banking world in this instance.
Right. Because the reason I'm asking from the outside, you know, I mean, the perception is very much that the crypto space is a dangerous place to operate if you're a bank. The iGaming space, the banks want to avoid it. Fintech, similar as well. Right or wrong, but obviously that is kind of the perception from the outside. And but you are saying that it's not actually a problem. It's more about having the competence and know-how in how to onboard the right clients and stay away from the wrong ones.
Yeah, exactly. And it's at the end of the day, it's all about source of funds, where that money comes from and where the money's going to. So your destination and target accounts. So if you know you're working with payment processors in India, for instance, now there may not be an Indian gaming, online gaming license there, and it may be a little bit grey market how it's working, but most operators are using the same handful of PSPs. It's not exactly illegal. It might not be exactly legal, but somewhere in the middle. But if we know that, and we know that PSP banks with us as well, and we know then, I don't know, pick random Maltese operator, Leo Vegas, get money coming from there, going into their account, then going out to their operational accounts, we know what that flow is, and we understand the procedure and the agreements behind that. Whereas if you were banking with a Barclays in the UK and some numpty on the third floor from compliance, that's a Barclays, they wouldn't have a clue how that works or what that works, and it would scare them. And the TransferWise guys didn't say we're not good for them. They're not going to make money from us because there's so much more work needs to be done. So it's all about return on investment at the end of the day in that sense. So, yeah, we understand the source and destination, and that makes it easy for a gaming company to come and work with us, especially at Metcalfe's Law. The more people we onboard into the banking network, then it becomes more intra-bank transfers and you're avoiding the corresponding banks, which can lead to the compliance issues and the documentation behind the source of funds then. Oh, can't hear you.
Oh, sorry. When do you expect to onboard your first client?
We have already. We were doing alpha at the moment in the middle of July. We've got 30 companies onboarding as a beta, and we expect to be fully live in September. Cool. If anyone wants to get banking, feel free to reach out to my salesman, Pierre Lind, who will happily introduce you. And...
All right. Well, why not, I guess.
I do believe iGaming Next will be banking with us as well. So one thing I love is working out the name for stuff like this and coming up with some funny stuff. So there's a few trademark issues with the current name is Ames Holdings. And the one I want, I've bought next.io, and I want to call it Next Generation Financial Services. So we have next.io as the banking, the next generation banking. Simple as that.
Exactly.
So, yeah, should be good.
It's a good domain. Maybe we'll get some some sub marketing from that as well with the next and be associated. Yeah. And who knows? Good.
Absolutely. I like it. go up here. Yeah.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I was going to sort of segue into where YOLO fits into all of this, exactly. Which may or may not have been your next question. And it's sort of like this is the fun part about what we're doing. Coin gaming is obviously making very good money, and that's wonderful. We're not ready to retire onto some island and drinking pina coladas. And so the question was, what do we do with these profits? And instead of doing, let's call it a Betson or approach where you go and do M&A and buy other companies and build them into your current process, I have more fun being an entrepreneur. So it's like, let's put the fun together and let's invest into the gaming world, invest into AI solutions, into SEO solutions, into streaming companies, into B2Bs, into B2Cs, into 8-slot companies to try and grow that ecosystem. But then on the fintech side, we've just invested into Curve, which you might know the UK one. We've become quite a material investor into them. We're looking at different vault we're looking at the moment, obviously to our banking network and what services we can put on top of that banking network. We like to invest and grow them. And now we're at a stage where 50% of the money in the fund is coming from Coin Gaming LP, and then now we're getting a lot of high net worth or others who have had success in the gaming industry now investing money into it as well as an LP. And that's quite exciting because when these smart entrepreneurs who have been through that process and had their exit, they don't know what to do with it all. So yeah, they like to invest with us. And then they like to come and have a WhatsApp group with us and talk strategy. And you know what? Then as the general partner of YOLO, I've then got this network of successful entrepreneurs that you had success in this country here. Mate, what would you do with this one here? I've got this opportunity and connect two people there. And then you've done this over here in banking in Singapore. Who how do we talk to the MFSA there? Who's your contact? And connect someone in there as well. Yeah. So the LPs still get to be involved in this wonderful, high, yeah, fast, volatile, not volatile, fast-paced industry of just strategizing and building a network and building that ecosystem. And, you know, where our job is obviously then provide returns on investment for that money, which we're doing, and we're loving doing it at the same time. So it's kind of like the next step, I believe, for successful entrepreneurs who have had that exit and now go, well, I want to be involved because I love the industry, but I don't want to be doing all the Jira tasks or Confluence tasks or all the different reports and whatnot. So it's a sort of viewing stage or viewing gallery to be a part of it, but not be operationally involved.
Right, right, right. And I mean, it's a powerful thing to start building this network, because obviously you want to be involved in this WhatsApp group. You want to have those connections. And it's not only about putting this investment in and having a direct return on that investment, but it's also about then obviously creating the network, and the network is everything in this day and age. But on that front, you know, Tim, what are YOLO's current like priorities? Like, are you actively searching new investment opportunities? What type of investment opportunities are you looking for? What are generally the updates right now in YOLO? And how big is the investment fund right now?
I'd say the investment fund's about 350 million euros, which right. is good fun. Yes, we've got five different funds. One is gaming, one is a fintech, one is our internal incubation, and we call it the Unicorn Farm Fund, which is sort of our. We've got a travel agency. We've got our accounting software where we're sort of incubating our own products, and we'll sell them into different funds later on. We've got obviously the Bombay Group, the Bombay Casino. We've just had a very interesting purchase on that one, a little fishing boat, 50 metres long, with four baccarat tables on the third floor for the player to have a priceless experience. And then the fifth one is a Southeast Asian digital fund, basically Asian gaming assets. Again, that full circle, and very heavily Japanese and Korean focused, which is obviously an interesting area for a lot of European operators at the moment. So we thought there's some good opportunity there to sort of consolidate some assets into a fund, raise more money, and then invest more, given our experience in those markets as well. I think over the last 2 years, we're up 246%. So that certainly beats a negative interest rate from the European Central Bank. Probably a 5% yield on a rental property, but you know, we're up 246, and I would honestly say we've got three unicorn companies within the portfolio which will be worth a billion within the next 2 to 3 years. So a lot of hard work goes into it, don't get me wrong, but we've got a great general partner team working and covering the world in their own areas of expertise, and we're building our team, the investment analysts and whatnot on the ground. And quite simply, you know, we do a quarterly update with all of the investments. Really simple, five slides, good, bad and ugly. And we've got the iGaming next one coming up. So, you know, it's a good time for the founders to actually, not to be forced to do it, but to take a moment to step back and go, right, in the last quarter, what's been good, what's been bad, what's been ugly? And let's talk about it, because you can be so caught up in the daily operational things, forget to take that step backwards. And that's almost what the framework we're trying to provide people, because we do it internally in Coin Gaming and it works really well. So why can't we use that model to help others grow their business and their valuations as well? In terms of new opportunities, we're always open to good ideas. Obviously, people submit pitch decks on our website, but we probably get 100 to 200 pitch decks a month, of which we'd invest in one. But majority of the investments will come from the network. So someone, I remember Steve Cutler, who's with Columba, he was talking to someone who's looking for money. Steve said, I know this person. Tim, have a chat to him. We got on a call, you know, and a week later we'd put 1.5 million euros into them. Coming through that trusted network, which is all what it's all about again, and then you're building off that one. And it, to me, it says the people we have invested into, they believe we add value, strategic value, that enough value that they will go and recommend us to other people to have an opportunity for us to invest into them as well.
Right. And a similar story between us then, of course, Tim. We were looking for investment last year and we were connected by Robin Reed, who's also an investor in the company. We had a telephone call. We were driving somewhere. We had a call for half an hour, 45 minutes. And the next week we agreed, and I think that's quite interesting in general, because I think, this was our first experience seeking funding, right? And when we started this process, we didn't know where to start. We didn't know how to go about it and so on and so forth. And I want to ask you, as a general partner of Yolo Investment, how do you take the decisions to invest in a company? Let's say that you are in our situation, we're not experienced, we haven't put together a pitch deck before, we're not professionals in how to optimize, let's say, the numbers or these type of things. How do you stand out? How do you get your attention if you have a good idea?
Mm-hmm. So I think the important thing, there's no such thing as a professional pitch deck. Pitch deck is a marketing. It's advertising. I prefer a one pager with dot points, and I want to filter through and understand what you were trying to achieve. Okay, number one, what are you solving? Number two, how you're going to solve it? And I don't want to say, there's an addressable market of 25 billion in them. this is bullshit. So I want to know this. Here's the problem we're going to solve. This is where we see the market moving in 12 months' time. With your help, Yolo, you can help us get to there by connecting through your network. And this is how we'll solve it. And we believe we can go to a valuation of X, Y, and Z. Now, we will do our due diligence on primarily the founders, but secondly, the problem which exists in the market and how they are going to attack and solve that problem. But the most important policy we have in Yolo, and this is we relied on so much, it's a no dickhead policy. in that, sometimes if we're going to work with people and whatnot, we want to make sure that we can get along with them, that we can share a joke, we can have a meal. We can sometimes say, hang on, stop what you're doing. This is wrong. And you don't want someone to go, we know better than you, la, la, la. We're all on the same side. So in that policy, it's like, are we going to enjoy this investment? And if we have everyone working towards a common goal, we can really grow that valuation. And that's primarily what that long-term view needs to be. So it is... Often, there was I don't really want to go into specifics, but there was an American company that we looked at in the blockchain world and in the Bitcoin world, and we were like, no, this would be annoying, honestly speaking. And I didn't feel like, why would we put ourselves through that hassle? How can we give our most to this venture if there's this sort of ambiguity there that we're not going to get along as a team? Because it is teamwork at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. So fortunately, Pierre, I must say you passed with flying colours that policy that you're not a...
That's the highest grade you can get, I guess.
Absolutely, badge of honour, yes. But it's also valuation. So there's a couple of different SOC companies we looked at, and while we would have loved to have got in and invested in at the stage when we could have, the valuation we thought was overvalued. Now, we couldn't get to a point where the valuation the founders want was here and what we thought was here based on our understanding of the market, and we had to sort of say, well, sorry, if we can't, we'd love to, but we can't go higher and they couldn't go lower. And that's sort of a frustrating point, but you've got to find the right balance and negotiating the valuations and whatnot as well. But there's some that we would love to have got involved in, but it wasn't right in terms of valuation for the return on. Our goal is to provide return on investment for our LPs, our limited partners. That includes Coin Gaming staff have options in these funds as well. That's our ultimate responsibility, is to provide them with a return on investment. If what we want to get into can only double or triple and a 3x return, then let's say coming in at something's at 100 million valuation, it might get to 300. Is that the potential best utilization of the funds we have? Whereas if we get into something at 5 million and drive it to 150, all of a sudden there's a 30x return, which is much, much better than a 3x return for someone's money. So there are a lot of different factors come into play, but we're learning as we go along as well. And ultimately, we want to have fun and enjoy it and, you know, provide the good, bad and ugly. And that's what it comes down to, to help people really look at the business, what they're doing, and understand where they want to get to.
Right, right, right. It's kind of like a... kind of like being in a relationship, you know. It's you need to make sure you get along, but also you need to there's other dynamics at play that needs to work as well. And it's like you say, love is not everything in a relationship, and it's the same thing here in the investment world, I guess.
Sometimes, you know, you need to negotiate. You need to have that hard conversation. You need to have that lovely, flowery, romantic conversation as well. You know, there's time for everything in there, but it is a partnership in the true sense of the form. It's not just here's our money, we'll close on, we'll see you in 12 months' time, because that's not it's not fun, not interesting.
Yeah.
So
right.
It's very, very from that perspective.
So any given marriage, for example, has a 50% chance of working out at the end of the day. What is the ratio in the investment world? Like, how many of the investment, in your experience, works out, and how many fail?
We'd probably count on 2 from 10 failing, 1 from 10 failing, something like that. Now, we'll obviously spend a lot of time with the ones which are struggling to try and find the right solution and the way forward. But sometimes... how does that? The arrogance sometimes of some of the founders doesn't allow them to listen to people who have made those same mistakes beforehand. Would expect 4, 5, 6 to do well, to be profitable. Might not reach their full potential, but certainly be profitable. Right. And one would hope at some stage to be bought. Would expect 2 to do extremely well and enjoy a 10, 20x return. And we expect 1 of 10 to be 100x. 200x, massive. Yeah. Thanks very much. Home run, unicorn type thing.
Yeah, right. So I know from like typical VC mindset is similar, right? It's like a typical VC would only invest in companies that have that 20-30x return opportunity. But they would at the same time expect most of those investments to fail. Like sometimes some VCs, I guess, are not interested in the 2-3x. It's basically 30x or nothing. But what you are saying is that you do appreciate kind of even if an organization does say 2x or 3x, and then you make an exit.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's I think you've got to look at your risk profile, and it's a bit like poker. You don't win every single hand. You're chasing a cluster. You don't always make it. So you've got to at least have a shot to be in there. That when you do hit that one, when you raise something like a 6-7 of spades, and you hit the monster 5-8-9 flop, no one's putting you on 6-7, and that's your big unicorn moment there. So you've having stability within the fund, which is going to provide a good return. But we're invested. We were in Evolution, for instance, Evolution stock when they had that dip. You know, we thought this is a good opportunity for the fund to buy. When Bitcoin went down, we obviously went and we bought a whole lot of Bitcoin because we felt it was a depressed price, and we sold out 48 hours later for a decent profit. So having those small wins are important, and it's a good stabilization. You can't just go all in on that, the Hail Mary unicorn, and hope for the best. We understand that a diversified portfolio is important, but we'll say, right, 10-20% will be in stocks, 10-20% will be in this, 60% will be in this, and we try and diversify our portfolio that way. So we're not just we're not just looking at pre-seed, pre-revenue type businesses. Sometimes coming into a business which is, you know, valued at 30 million, making a couple of $100,000 a month in profit, EBITDA, can be a good bet, because we know from that 30 million will go to 150 million because we know who we're going to sell them to in 12 months' time anyway. It's a good time to get in there and lock in a 5X. We did one that was called Yeka, Chinese-facing company, point of sales terminal, 30,000 B2B, small to medium enterprise B2B customers in China, and they aggregated the different payment methods. What they did was they did all the data science around the payment cash flow and offered 3-day loans to the small and medium sized enterprises, because they knew their cash flow needs of those enterprises better than Mr. Wong, the fruit shop man himself. So they made this massive business out of doing 2- and 3-day loans at a 20% APR interest rate for 2 days, because they knew he needed 3 days of cash to get through. Now, they went and floated in the Hong Kong Stock Exchange for $1.8 billion And we got in at a $350 million valuation. So we did a 6X on that, and we rode it for 6 months. And then, yeah, we said thanks very much and cashed out. There's another one, M17 in Japan. It's the biggest streaming company in Japan and Korea, and they'll go and float soon. And there's another one, I think it's DoorDash, I think it's the American version of it, again, about to float in Hong Kong. It's valued at $3.5 billion. So that might only be a 4 to 6X return, but that gives us more playing capital to now reinvest into more ones. And, you know, Doyle Brunson said, they said, oh, you always tend to get lucky. And he goes, no, I win a lot of small pots, which allows me to get lucky in the big pots. So... Yeah, different ways of looking at it in that sense.
I love that. Just if you have an opportunity, Tim, just think, what would Doyle Brunson do in this situation, and just do what he does when he has an
absolutely,
and you'll always be fine. Yeah. Great. So Tim, you know what's interesting to me, you know, coming into this process is just what you mentioned before. It's a lot about who are the founders. And for me, I did not understand that, for example, when we started our process. And it's something I learned along this process, that it's a lot about who are the founders and kind of can you trust them, and are they go-getters kind of thing? Do they set high ambitions and so on and so forth? So what I've learned, and correct me if I'm wrong, but sometimes the project it's in itself is actually not what is the most important thing. It is like, can you find the right talent to basically, and they will find a way kind of thing. Is that fair to say?
And I think it comes back to what I said before. Identifying the problem you're trying to solve. And then there's many different ways that problem could be solved. But finding the right founder, he will go with, he's got one vision. This is how we're going to solve it. 3 months into it, 6 months into it, may need to pivot to solve it a different way. And that's the quality of founder who is humble enough to understand that it's not just my way or the highway, that the sands will shift over time. But to have that, there is a goal of the issue we're trying to solve here, and we're going to find our way to solve it however we need to do it. And that's where the strength of character of the founder or founders come into play, that they're open enough to introspectively review what they're doing and how they're thinking. Because the company is bigger than the man, and it must always be this way. You know, the company must always come first, and what we're trying, and then we're working for the company, you know, and as long as the people working for the company have this desire to work, then that's the type of people we like to invest into. And, you know, we can, what do they say, skill can be taught, but passion can't be. You know, you can't buy passion for something, and that's so important that we are finding founders who, you know, we're investing hard-earned money. It's hard to earn $1 million these days. And you've got to really work hard and solve a lot of problems and have people willing to pay you for that opportunity to help them solve their own problems. So if we're going to go put $1 million into something, you know, we've got to be very sure that the person we're investing into, they're into this for the long term, and they want to take the approach and they want to push forward, and they're going to push through the highs and the lows and the bads and the goods. And the strength of character really, really comes into play there.
Right. Someone who said that in today's world, it's the most difficult time ever to become a millionaire, but it's the easiest time to become a billionaire. I thought that was a good quote.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's easy to become a billionaire as such, but anyway.
the people have always said the first million is the hardest, and absolutely. It's, you know, that's where you're trying out different ideas and concepts and business models. And, you know, if we're writing a bit of a history of the Coin Gaming Group at the moment, and the amount of failed businesses we had over the last 20 years, it's taken up the first 15 chapters of the book, you know. It's, but we always learned something from every single one, that we know we can't do that next time. And, you know, and the biggest one for us from the poker world was to be in control of the money. Then we can do anything. And so that we found then BitCasino in 2014, with Bitcoin, we can control the wallets, that we're in control of the money, and we can decide to pay a player the winnings within 1 minute. But it's an interesting time to live in that regard. I think you've got a lot of noise around whether it is work at home, work from the office. I know we were just talking about before in Malta looking for some property there. I think an office is going to be somewhat changed a little bit, where it's going to be, this is 2 or 3 days a week where you have your meetings, you have your face-to-face, you have your coffee machine chats, you have that personal interaction, but probably you can probably work from home because you can be more switched on with blinkers, and it will be a transformative stage in how this. I don't think it can always just be from home, and I don't think it'll ever be only just from work from 9 to 5. I disagree with the 9 to 5. I like to sleep in. I start at 11 and I get a good night's sleep because I work a little bit late sometimes. But why should it be one glove fits everybody? Not everybody wants a 9 to 5 role in today's world. And a coder might be sitting up with a Diet Coke. He might work for the 2 in the morning. Good on him. Then let him come in at 11 o'clock. It's like, what provides value to the company at the end of the day?
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more with that. You know, and it's something we've gone through in our business as well, is understanding these new dynamics that have come out of the pandemic. And we sit wall in wall with RakeTech, big affiliate, of course. And they have taken this remote first approach, where they hire staff from all over Europe, essentially. And they don't force them to be in the office. Now you can say, again, like you mentioned, the office definitely has a place. And those coffee discussions, that's where the big ideas come from. You know, it's important to leave it at. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's where a lot of the ideas come from and stuff like that. But RakeTech made the argument that, you know, if you operate an office in Malta, for example, your talent pool is within, you know, a radius of 10 kilometers of the office. That is where your talent pool lies, you know. And all of a sudden now they can open up to a talent pool all over Europe. Right, so they can hire people from any country, from anywhere, and just find the best people who actually see this as a selling point in the process, where you can work as long as you're in kind of a similar time zone or things like that, and as long as you get your job done and stuff like that. And there's a give and take here, I think, but I think as we go forward, the employees will see this as a selling point, and I think it's it's important to also.
How do you build a culture then? If you're a fully remote team, how do you build a culture of expectation of similar values? And I think this is the most important thing in business, is to have those similar values of where you want to get to and how you want to build a business and what good looks like, what bad looks like, what that challenging conversation looks like. That if you're never meeting in person, you know, we have 40 nationalities in the company here. Now, they're all on Slack. And you know what? Most people have English as a second language. How do you put across your emotions and your feelings when it's a one-sentence line? We always say now, pick up the phone and do a Zoom call so you can at least express your emotions when you're talking to people. But when you're in person, you know, that's such a different world that you can build that culture much, much, much better.
Can I make a proposal here, Tim? A bold prediction, let's say. I think maybe... Yeah. That this is the argument of the older generation. The younger generation live primarily across the screens, and they don't see the point of meeting in person. They can do everything over screen. So in 10 years' time, we will look back on this as this is the old mindset.
I agree with you, Pierre, and it scares me because. You know why? Because you get limited attention spans from the younger people using their 30-second TikToks and their Instagram stories and whatnot. And I'm on TikTok. Don't worry, I like checking it out and knowing what people are doing. But I've noticed the attention span is much shorter, and it's a very selfish culture. If there's nothing in it for me, why on earth would I do it for the company? Now, how do you instill those, let's call it prehistoric values that, you know, parents and grandparents have built into us as we've gone through and running business and doing whatnot. But there just seems to be this all about me culture, and I want to work from home, I want to do this. What do you give back? What are you doing for other people to help the world be a better place?
Yeah, it's like sometimes you have to like burn down the house in order to build it up again. Maybe the structures will just be different. Like maybe we haven't figured out exactly how to build a culture in a remote organization completely yet. But someone made an interesting argument who were teaching, you know, is remote work a good thing or not? And they made an argument. I think it's really interesting that, like, if you have an organization where part of the organization is working remote and part of the organization works in an office, for example, that is the worst combination. Because then you'll have part of the organization building one culture and part of the organization building another culture. And the argument was that you have to do either or, essentially, and build the organization based on one or the other. And maybe that is kind of the truth lies within that, so to say. And I think maybe that's the mistake that a lot of organizations do. They try to be in both boats at the same time. They have to try to have the cookie and eat it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're in new territory. Corona 6-8 months ago forced this upon us. It's it was talked about previously. I think who was that group? Basecamp. They used to do very much remote working 5 years ago, and they were very big proponents of it. But now the pandemic has forced us to try and work out how we're going to deal with this. And people don't know. There's no precedent there to go, this is the way we do it, you know, because take this example, it worked for them. I truly believe trying to find that blend of not a work from office, work from home, but I want to say work from home, but please be in the office from 3 to 5 for a meeting, for coffee on Tuesday, Thursday and Friday. That's all we ask. But otherwise, you can work from home or the office, up to you, whichever you want. But there's a small amount of time we need to have that face-to-face to do the town hall meeting, the AMA amongst the company, because this dissemination of information doesn't work as well across Slack. And, youngsters might not appreciate that it's important, but, heck, we're meant to be the wise old men here, Pierre, that we've been around the block a few times.
We're not that old.
But we know... We're not that old, but, you know, we know that information dissemination is so important. We need to put the foot down a little bit and say, no, Friday afternoons, everyone in the office, or Tuesday afternoons, everyone in the office, and, you know, we'll put the bean bags out and whatever Gen Y, X, or what is it these days, Gen Millennial, whatever crap you want, you can have it. But this is our expectation. Gen C.
That's the latest one, yes.
That's a new one.
That's a kid's one, yeah. but yes, I mean.
Interesting times.
I mean, what tends to emerge here now, there was I think a lot of knee-jerk reactions. It's like, this company, we're going to go fully remote, whatever. Like, that's what was, and everyone was celebrating them. Wah, wah, wah. But it's still very early, like you were saying, like we're still kind of finding our feet. What's emerging now, I think, is... if we want to look at the iGaming industry, an example is Betsson, who is doing this hybrid, right? And you were speaking about that as well, where twice a week, work from the office. 3 times a week, do what you want. And they also kind of allow you to travel for 2 weeks a year and work, essentially. So what I'm doing now, I'm in Sweden, enjoying the forest here in the middle of nowhere, peace and quiet, and I work much better than I do usually, right? So Betsson allows me, if I would work there, to do that 2 weeks a year. And if we're looking at a higher level than Apple, I don't know if you're paying attention, but this has been a big issue, a big discussion in the tech world, right? Because Apple have gone out now publicly with their policies saying that we're going to offer hybrid work. I think it's same like Betsson. I think either 2 or 3 days you can work from home, but 2 days, you have to be at the office. And this has been a massive discussion within the tech industry of basically... the employees are rebelling against it. How dare they? Yeah. How can you be so backward thinking in this like modern way where everyone can work whatever they want? And then Apple is there like, well, hold on a minute. We just invested like $20 billion in this spaceship, modern, like whatever world-class office. Like, we actually want you to use it. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah. And sometimes people don't realize we build our office here and we put a lot of money into try and make it as good as possible. I want people to come and use it, you know. It's otherwise, why do we bother?
Yeah.
So exactly. You can see that to the both ways. Now, the RegTech example is really good. Finding developers at the moment is really, really difficult, especially in Eastern Europe where we're predominantly based, and trying to look further afield and having people work. Now, whether we set up a base we've got an office in Sao Paulo. Perhaps we need to make that into a tech hub as well. We're looking for Alexia developers. So anyone watching who does Alexia, we'd love to have a chat. But maybe you need to have strategic locations around the world where you base your development teams and have that 24-hour cycle of work going on, as opposed to everybody come and centralize into one location. But we're struggling to find them. And if you can widen your talent pool, it certainly makes good sense to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It'll be interesting to see how that is going to, because the developers have the power, right? Like they can work wherever they want, which for any company in the world, pretty much, if you're a good developer. So it's difficult for an organization to kind of force the developers to move somewhere, because they're like, fuck you, I'm gonna work for the other seven companies that I have the opportunity to work for, and it's in their terms.
In my own hours and whatever terms I want. Exactly right. And you know, you can be in Kharkiv in Ukraine, or you can be in Venezuela or Mexico or Germany, and you can, or Macedonia, and you can work for any company remotely now. So it does push those prices up again. And it's not just about coming and working for that company in that office. I think there is some decentralization happening. The world's become decentralized.
Decentralized,
speaking. Yeah, and in all ways of thought and in mind and process and money and banking as well. And even marketing, we're looking at our marketing. We don't want to just have a marketing team doing one channel. We want to build a platform or a framework, and anyone can come and build in, work into our framework of how we do things, but anyone can do marketing with us. And it's not just, this is going way beyond just affiliates, but it's whoever's got expertise in an area in a region, they can hook into our platform and do marketing and earn a percentage of the action. And we're decentralizing that whole process, but we've got a common reporting standard underneath it, which is the most important thing to understand your return on investment the whole way through.
Right. Speaking of decentralization, Tim, let's slide into something different here, because it's interesting to me. I like to think from first principles when I kind of approach a problem, and basically breaking down the issue to its very core, asking the very core questions. And, you know, so I've been thinking a lot about the blockchain and crypto space lately. And, you know, the whole premise of the success of the community that has been built around Bitcoin and the other cryptos is this premise of decentralization, right? So the Bitcoin purists, they didn't like Bitcoin Cash, right? Because it was less decentralized. They want Bitcoin to be decentralized as much as it possibly can. But I want to challenge us a little bit. Like, why is decentralization, is it so obvious that it's a good thing, decentralization? Because you would also imagine that it could potentially not be so good. That's like, it's kind of like anarchism in a way, no?
Well, is a democracy better than totalitarianism?
Exactly. It's a valid question.
One I'm not going to answer on this podcast. Yeah.
It's a deep question for a Monday afternoon, I guess.
in my perspective, I think the way the world is working, the way it is so easy for me to employ someone in Manila to do a 5-minute task and pay them to do that task for me. That couldn't have happened 50 years ago. You can connect with people anywhere around the world. You can do your Zoom calls, your WhatsApps, your Telegrams. You can now move money instantaneously and seamlessly, that it's in reach to everyone to use all four corners of the globe to run business, to do business. Now, 20 years ago, fax machines, you know, I remember in the bank they used to have this, you got an invoice in, you had to send a bank guarantee that you had the money to pay, you had the money available to pay the invoice once the invoice had received. They needed that bank guarantee to be notarized and something like this. I'm like, my godfather, you know, what a backward way of doing things. Now we can just press a button and the money moves instantaneously across the world, and you're paying for goods and services. You can run it through escrow, for instance, very, very seamlessly and efficiently. So is decentralization a good thing? I think that it's here to stay in all shapes, forms, and manners. If we go back and look at what Uber has done, which is probably the biggest proponent of the decentralization business model, Uber don't own cars, but they connect demand with supply. Airbnb connecting demand with supply, and it doesn't matter from what direction that comes in, it is a decentralized marketplace with a set of common rules which can be governed by a central body or by a decentralized body who have agreed on a number of principles, which is, you know, a DAO, a decentralized autonomous organization. So it's not just that there's one person here, they control all the supply and all the distribution of the demand. Now we're coming from all directions, and this is a shifting landscape in the economy. So I think everything is becoming decentralized. Even people's travel, for instance, you don't just go. I mean, I know the Estonians used to always go down to Egypt for their package holiday. People don't go to that. They're not single-minded. I want to go A to B, and that's all I'll do. People going out, Australia, Canary Islands, America, South America, it's become a lot more widespread and a lot more open mindset, if that makes sense. So trying to bring it back to business, yes, decentralization opens up different skill sets from around the world, which can efficiently be communicated and produced across the internet because high-speed data is there. So will it reshape the way banking? 100% it will. There's no doubt about it. Are central monetary policies and governments worried about controlling their monetary policy through what was traditionally a centralized policy? Yeah, they are not very happy with a decentralized model because they lose control. But in essence, do you need to have a single body in control the whole time, or do you let market forces? One of the great examples, so we went through that 2007 financial thing, and I think it was RBS got bailed out because the government said, RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland, it's too big to fail, and it would be detrimental to the economy if it failed. Now, the Bitcoin world went through Mt. Gox, which had 10% market share of all Bitcoin. Yes, it was too big to fail. You know what? The market is so efficient. It took that in, and you know what? Bitcoin didn't fail. It found a way to adjust itself to the new climate, which has happened. So you've got policymakers who, in their opinion, something is too big to fail, and they're scared that they don't know what will happen if it's a free-floating monetary policy. Decentralization is a free-floating monetary policy, in essence. And if something happens, the market will adjust itself. Great, good. This allows pure demand and supply to work in the purest form. And if there's an arbitrage opportunity in the Korean Bitcoin exchange to moving won and trying to get that money out, people will work out a way how to take advantage of that arbitrage in a free market policy environment. So I see that happening on a scale. I see marketing. I see social media is somewhat on this decentralized basis now. That it just means that there's no one saying there's only one way to do this, and don't you dare think about another way to do it because we're scared it might not work. And that's that's what it ultimately comes down to. Which, if take this to the gambling world, something that we will be launching very soon, maybe in a year, in 6 months or a year, is a decentralized casino. And it's going to be called casino.io. I've been sitting on the domain for quite some time. And we're building up all these assets around us, be it a live dealer studio, whether it be a banking network, whether it be platform, affiliate system, whatever, because I want to put it all into one system and say 30,000 people can invest into a bankroll of a casino bankroll, which we know returns 2.14% per annum. 2.414% per bet. 4% on slots, 2% on live dealer. Anyone can invest into that, and then any player can play, and it's going to using what's that betting analogy? You can have 0.5% of your overall bankroll can be bet at any one time. Programmatically work out how big the bets are. Then you've got a decentralized casino, which can become the biggest casino in the world. All we do, we run an operation and a platform and take a little percentage of every single bet. But better than borrowing money from the central bank at a negative interest rate, better than a 5% yield on property, better than a managed fund. And, you know, we're going to build up a secondary market to buy and sell using smart contracts, units in a casino, and fully regulated. That's why we have investment funds and licenses and all the other stuff. But I see this as the way forward for the gaming world. Why should it just be one organization, many punters into one organization? It should be in many-to-many relationship.
Right. So the concept of decentralization is not just a trend. It is here to stay. It's an improvement to society and how we deal with money, and not only money, but obviously NFTs and DeFi, all the things that comes into the world, and that I'm sure that's only going to expand, and there'll be new concepts and these other things. But the decentralization and the tools that are now enabling true decentralization is what's going to kind of change the world in that respect, then removing that middleman.
You know, the best part of this is that we're 10 years into the journey.
Yeah, right. It's internet.
It's only been around for 10 years. We're 2000, year 1995, 1997 in the evolution of the internet. What can happen over the next 10, 20 years? And remember, the speed of adoption and the speed of learning and innovation is now so much faster than it was 50 years ago. I'm scared. Well, actually, pretty excited, to be honest, where we're going to get to in the next 5-10 years, because it's going to move at lightning speed. And this is the opportunity for all companies to sit there and, no, it's never going to. People don't use checkbooks anymore. Sorry, money has changed over time. People don't really use credit cards anymore.
Can you tell this to the banks in Malta, please? Can you tell this to the institutions in Malta? We're still getting checks paid by invoices.
Didn't they all close down, Pierre?
Yeah. I've never even seen a check in my whole life before I moved to Malta.
Have you? Oh, last time I used one was 1995. But, you know, that was a way of doing business. That's now moved on. People don't really use credit cards. Now, most people put that credit card into Apple Pay and you hold your phone near the thing and you double click, or you put it into Curve in the UK and you're using a single card to aggregate all your cards. You don't swipe. I don't remember the last time I put the card in and pressed the PIN number anymore. Doesn't happen. So things will move forward. People love efficiency because people are time poor. And that's the biggest resource we're going to try and solve at the moment, is how to win back time for people to do the smart thinking and not the monotonous thinking. And I think that's the key crux to thinking big. The name of this podcast is, how do we win time to think big? And all the things to do that is to solve the problems of where you're taking up too much time doing monotonous tasks, which could be automated by a computer, but then it takes time to stop and actually solve that, to do it, which is why we're trying to invest in the things in that ecosystem to win back more time, to let us think bigger, because we know that the new world's going to come really, really, really quickly.
Right. And I mean, there are concepts out there now that are happening today that is just so fucking fascinating. I mean, you know, we talked a little bit before the podcast here about the DeFi space in the blockchain world, and neither you or me understand it well enough to kind of educate anyone. But the basic premise is that now, you know, you can remove the middleman, the bank, essentially, and create much, much higher yields by taking loans or offering, locking up your own money for others to lend without the bank, and, you know, generating leads yields of like 10%. Of money that you can lend out to others via blockchain solutions. It's just the space is just, it's happening so quick. It's, everything's happening so fast.
About that is your smart contracts, and you're exactly right. People still need to leverage and they need cash to do things. Now, let's say you're sitting on a pile of Ethereum or Bitcoin. You don't really want to sell that, so you're happy to go and put that into a smart contract, and you've got the collateral there. You can then borrow 2/3 of the value. So you're at a 150% debt to equity ratio, or whatever it is, you know, 10,000 here, borrow 6,700 here. Now, you can utilize that cash and you're happy to pay back at a 5.5%, 6%, 7%, 8% rate, because that cash can be used to do something. Now, if that Ethereum price goes up, then you need less. If the price goes down, you might need to put some more in there, but people can lend money into that and earn 4%, and the person who's running the smart contract is in there 1%. This is, you don't need to go through some antiquated compliance bank manager lending process and a lending committee, investment committee. Yeah, my godfather, you know, this is so old fashioned. If you've got the collateral, give me a loan. Forget about my credit rating. Here's the collateral. Here's my loan. I can earn money putting that in there for my DeFi and my farming. I can use the money for my thing. I can pay it back at the right time. Collateralize properly. Thanks very much. Game on. Smart contract. Life's good. Done.
Right.
Do it in 1 minute.
Right. I mean,
and that's where it's moving to.
You know, if you hear this concept, I remember when I heard about the DeFi the first time as well, just a couple of months ago. I still don't understand it, but anyway, it's just like, what the hell is this? Does this mean? You know, in general, like, you are literally removing. You can take a loan and you remove the bank from the equation. You do basically, from person to person. You never met, you don't know each other, but through the smart contracts, you're effectively enabling these loans to take place without any risk as well, somehow. Yeah, which is, but it's the future. I mean, it is clearly, this is enabling a platform to remove these ridiculous, crazy fees that we have just taken for granted in the history of banking, essentially. And all of a sudden, you can yield these like massive returns just because you remove the bank from the equation.
And I think this is where the Bitcoin analogy of the ability to move a thing of value between two untrusted parties.
Right.
And that's the greatest thing which has come of it, because, you know, I can send you something of value between two untrusted parties, and I know there's a smart contract there dictating, programmatically dictating how this will work, which is open. It's an open source contract that anyone can review and see how it works. If there's no room for dispute because you've got that collateral in at the same time. But traditionally, you had a relationship with your bank manager, you know, and the bank manager then, that you didn't have a relationship with who lent the money to the bank in the first place. No. The banks got greedy and earned too much money. So, you know, in our banking network, we want to build in, we want to be the smart contract producer of connecting two parties together and allow that DeFi to happen, because we're going to hold, obviously, treasury funds for a number of gaming companies. There's no point in just sitting there doing nothing. Let them invest in a safe, regulated, smart contractual environment, which could earn 5% on your treasury funds. No risk. This is good. This is fantastic. Yeah. So,
yeah,
a lot of opportunities to come from it all.
Lots of opportunities. You know, Tim, you mentioned here before that you feel a bit scared of the pace that it's taking place, but also excited. And you know, the Jordan Peterson says, or it's actually one of the classic psychologists that I can't remember the name, but let's say Jordan Peterson. He said that the true meaning of happiness is when you have one foot in the unknown and one foot in the known. So kind of like this discussion that we're having here right now. We are kind of toying with these ideas. We know a little bit and we are in the unknown to other extents and so forth. And that is the closest you can get to be truly happy, is when you are in that space between the known and the unknown. But I want to just go completely off. Yeah, I want to go completely off topic here. Like what makes you happy, Tim? As a hard worker and building your organization.
both my parents were school teachers, and I think that would be that's in my blood to teach people, and I really get a kick out of mentoring people and teaching them, and you know, helping them become better people themselves, and to live by good principles in life. And then from a business perspective, I want to make people wealthy. I don't want to make them rich, which is, you know, cash flow pissing up against the wall. That's not interesting. I want people to have their home, their family, their 2.3 kids and a dog in a backyard, you know, the hills hoist if you're in Australia. I want people to enjoy life, that they don't need to worry about where the next dollar comes from, that they've got a good, stable foundation to then go and enjoy those creative things in life. Now, whether that creative thing be playing cricket on a Saturday or, I don't know, painting, whatever they want to do to maximize life. And if I can help create that financial stability for my 600 employees and people who will entrust their money into Yolo as an LP, that I can go and make a return from them, you know, they're trusting me to do that. I've got this huge desire and almost discipline that I want to get out there and do the best for everyone possible. Some call it me being way too generous, but I think that's a good thing, to bring a smile to people's lives and, you know, live life to the truest way, be principled and be good values in life. And then YOLO, you get one chance at this thing. I had a few friends from school and university who've unfortunately passed away at, you know, in the early 40s, and it sort of brings it all into perspective for you. You know, you don't live forever, so live today that it might be your last, unfortunately, but make the most. Don't put off. If you want to go and do something, don't say, oh, I'm too busy, oh, I'll do that next week or next year. Actually, do it now,
and make
the most of it. And so my goal is to give people that opportunity to sort of remove that concerns in life. Yes, in return, I expect they work hard and they derive value and they drive a return on investment for the company, and that's to be expected. You know, and our invested companies, I want them to work hard and to dream big and to go big and and enjoy the journey. You know, we're at work for a third of our day, if not a half of our day in some cases. Enjoy it.
Right.
Make it meaningful and enjoy what you're doing. And how do you add value? And how can you look back and be proud of what you've done? You know, from my perspective as well, I'm big into the cricket, so I'm building cricket grounds here in Estonia. We want two things. We want the best cricketing facilities in Europe, but we want to have 1,000 Estonian kids playing cricket every Saturday morning. And the whole board of the Estonian Cricket Association and myself building and buying the grounds and building them up and spending money on this, we've got a common goal, 1,000 kids playing cricket every Saturday morning. That would all make us very, very proud of what we've achieved from a sort of altruistic venture in that sense. So yeah, it's good and life is good, and you know, you live it once, make the most of it, and don't sit there procrastinating and putting things off. And I know it's difficult for people, but you've got to just make it happen.
Yeah, right. I think that's fantastic, Tim, in general, and it shows, of course, you know, and that is like I said, your name comes up very often in meetings and people that I meet in the industry and stuff like that. And it's always for this positive reason. So I'm not going to build you up here too much, but you should take that as a compliment, of course. Yeah, that's enough. So that's the compliment you get. What about money? Can money influence happiness as well? Can money make you happy? You have experience here, Tim. Teach us.
Money can ensure you have a good lunch every day. You're healthy and you're not living on the breadline. But money by itself doesn't make you happy, because it can be easy come, easy go. And people think that's a great thing, but actually you need to be smart about it. You need to invest it. You need to be, you know, I find one thing I do quite regularly with guys at Coin Gaming, I've turned into a sort of an impromptu financial advisor on giving them, I feel like, fatherly advice on financial planning. I don't know why it may, but, you know, it is about having, you know, bankroll management, which you learn from poker, and money can give you stability and a foundation to then go and explore those creative things and passions you have in life, and they bring you happiness. If you're worried about living paycheck from paycheck, which unfortunately some people in this world have, then you don't have time to go and explore those passions, which will bring you happiness in life. So money itself doesn't bring happiness, but it allows you to build a framework and a foundation to be happy. But certainly it makes it easier to explore these things, to travel, to see the world, to eat at good restaurants and different foods, and you know, skydiving, if you like that. It's, you know, whatever the passions are, it allows you to enjoy those things there. But it's not to be pissed up against the wall, and you should never just throw money away. And I remember in the poker days, you had guys who were making way too much money way too easily, and they had no financial control or management, that you see them now 10 years later and they've got nothing. And you think, poor person, you had that such a good opportunity. If only you switched your head a little bit and put some money away and invested here, bought some property and put that aside for the rainy day, and then sort of giving yourself a good platform in life. But hey, that's what life's about, making decisions. And if you make more good decisions than bad ones, then you'll enjoy life and be off to a good day.
Without the risk of sounding ridiculous, what's your greatest fear, Tim?
Greatest fear?
It's Monday afternoon. You seem fearless. I mean, that's what I'm asking. Exactly. I mean, because you seem fearless. I mean, you've been building and building and building. You take on high risk projects by the sounds of it. I mean, you're constantly pursuing, pushing the limits. Is this even a consideration?
My greatest fear is not taking a moment to stop and smell the roses, probably, Pierre. And it probably comes from my mum. She was a school teacher for many, many years, and she retired from a school in Australia. And at her farewell speech, she said, and now I've finally got a chance to stop and smell the roses. 15 years later, my mum, when did you stop? I'm writing books now, doing this, doing this, doing this. So I think I'm cut from the same cloth that I think it's important. My fear is finding enough balance in life to raise a family, to be a good father, to be a good husband, to provide for the people around me and to look after people and just making sure I find balance in life. That would be my biggest fear, but it's something I'm certainly working on and, you know, trying to stay fit and lose a few extra kilograms, which you can get carried away with work too much where your diet turns to shit and you forget to exercise and, you know, you could have a stroke at 50 and now what's the point of doing it all if you can't actually stop and smell the roses for a little bit. So that would be my biggest fear, and it's something I'm really privileged that I've got some good people around me who consistently remind me of this, and it's certainly feedback well taken and acknowledged to. I have no meetings on a Friday now. I've got that in my calendar, and it's a good start to a little bit more balanced lifestyle. So,
right. And the rumors here went, Tim, obviously, that there was a high level paddle game that took place here the other week in Marbella, where our dear Robin Erik Reed got to taste the taste of defeat.
And tell you what, when Robin's buying your beers because he lost a panel match, those beers taste very nice and cold.
Very good. they are deep in there. It's gonna hurt him. Brilliant, Tim.
I think there's a bit of training from Robin. I know we're going to have a paddle tournament in November in Malta, the iGaming Next paddle tournament, and looking forward to the rematch. So bring it on.
Right. We do a big crowd. We do some side bets. There's some hot dogs there as well, maybe, and we make it happen. Yeah, Tim, I think this is a great note to end things today. It's been absolutely fun. We've been sitting here for 1 hour 40 minutes almost. too slow away. So I know you're a busy man, and I always appreciate. I love having this podcast for this reason, because I get an excuse to talk to the people that I looked up to, and they come on board, they speak to me and things. So it's fantastic. This is why I do this podcast. So Tim, thank you so much for today, and a lot of words from you as well.
I'm loving the journey with iGaming Next, that, you know, there's no limits or boundaries to what we can do with thinking outside the box. So podcasts are great. I listen when I'm driving. I always listen to the next iGaming Next podcast, and I love jumping on the club talk, the clubhouse on a Thursday morning, and just sharing and listening and learning. And I think it's three things that you can never get enough of. So I recommend everyone jump on and share a bit, listen a bit, and learn a bit. It's good for you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Tim. I'll see you in person soon.
Good, Pierre. Yeah. Have a good day. Cheers.